Hello and welcome. It's your Weekend Managing Madrid podcast. This is your host, Gabe Lesra. Joining me by the interwebs, Keon Sobhani. Keon, how's it going?
I'm doing fantastic. Look forward to this.
Yeah, me too. I'm psyched. I'm happy to make my triumphant return to the free show for all you freeloaders who listen every week.
I feel like you say that like every week. I don't know. Do you? I feel like you take a hiatus and then come back every week.
That's maybe true. Maybe it's just that I miss doing it. So no, I mean, like, I've missed the last couple, I think, of free shows. I've done our midweek show, I think, a couple times in a row now, but it's not the weekend show.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm back, and Om Arvin also joining us. Om, I've been listening to your performances. I think you've been doing a really good job. I also am really psyched that you have your new mic because you sound way better.
Yeah, I've been getting some positive responses from listeners ever since I got my mic. So definitely been a great investment. Thank you to all our patrons for making this possible, because we used your money to buy this. So psyched to have the new mic.
So if that's if you like what you're seeing, you can always chip in. The next thing we can do is update the software and, buy me another bottle of wine. So, no, in all seriousness, we do invest essentially every dollar of this back into the show so far. So
next step would essentially be like a studio, maybe.
Or like getting, I mean, for me at least, it would be getting some shit so that my voice doesn't echo so much, but on my walls at least. Or maybe getting some better recording software.
Let's be clear, your voice is like amazing.
Yeah, it's made for the radio.
It's Om and I who need the mic. You could get away with just recording into a potato or something, and it would still sound amazing.
We all know that's bullshit. Though it's funny because one of the like classic jokes that you say to people, if you want to like give them an underhanded compliment, it's like, oh man, you should do radio. You got a face made for radio. So yeah, let's talk about Real Madrid. Big win for Madrid this week, 4-0 against Alaves, who are still, they were kind of a revelation last season. Then Madrid took a couple of their best players, and now they're not quite the same team. So 4-0 in the Bernabeu to a largely happy crowd, I think. So guys, what were your kind of overall impressions of this match? I mean, top to bottom, team looked pretty good, I thought.
It was a fun performance against a team that was really in form. Like, Abelardo took these guys and they were literally dead. Like, they were flipping through coaches, and obviously in the post-Pellegrino era and post-Llorente, post-Teo, just hasn't really worked out for them. And, you know, they signed Guidetti, who, in my opinion, I'm not a huge Guidetti fan. I appreciate what he brings to the table at some points, but he's not a lethal finisher or anything. But I think the biggest difference for them is Abelardo's had them playing really good. So you kind of go into this game thinking, well, they've had a couple losses in this huge run. One was against Barca, one was against Bilbao. And you think, they'll probably give you a tough game. And I thought they gave some trouble in the first half, but nothing crazy. And I thought, unlucky for them, which Abelardo also mentioned after the game, was that they were facing Real Madrid's best moment of the season in terms of like form in the calendar. Like, they're just kind of surging right now. And I thought it was like a really fun performance, which we'll get into. But obviously the highlights here were BBC. And it's kind of interesting, though, when you look at it, it's not like your traditional front three BBC. It was kind of like a quartet in a 4-4-2, because Bale played on the left. And it wasn't so much a 4-3-3, and Lucas Vazquez was the fourth player who was really good in attack.
Right. I mean, it was certainly kind of a banner game for Lucas Vazquez, who really exploited the huge, vast amount of space that he was given on that side, given that the BBC seemed concentrated on the other side of the pitch, kind of combining with each other. Though, again, it was this kind of classic BBC game where there was a lot of shifting around, a lot of intermixing, and a lot of just creating outside of sort of the normal structures that we would see. Although Lucas Vazquez is very much the opposite of that. Just if you look at his heat map, I remember, like, this is another classic Vazquez game in that you could just draw a line directly down the center of the pitch, and he literally there was it was hot on that one side and totally nothing on the other, which was funny.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like you bring up the heat map, but the other thing that's interesting about that is like you look at Bale was obviously really pretty focused on the left flank, and that's where he was. And also, Benzema and Ronaldo also were attacking from the left a lot. So you kind of had this overload on the left flank. But then you had Carvajal and Lucas Vazquez in particular hugging the right flank. So anytime Real Madrid could switch the play, Alaves kind of just had to would really collapse. So I thought the point of emphasis on the flanks was it was really conducive to Real Madrid scoring goals the way they had it set it up.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, Om, did you? I mean, what were your thoughts on sort of the tactical setup and then the way that it all kind of unfolded?
So, I was a bit surprised with how conservative Alaves came out to contest the match, essentially, because like Kian said, they had picked up form since they brought on Abelardo as a new coach, and I expected them to come out and do more, but They were content to basically sit back most of the game and allow Real Madrid to come onto them. And I don't know if that was the best strategy, because if there was one criticism I had of Real Madrid the entire game is that we looked a bit sloppy passing out from the back, especially in the first 20 to 30 minutes of the game. And whatever token pressure Alaves applied on our back line had some kind of effect. And we tended to give the ball away stupidly for whatever reason. And I felt like if Alaves tried a more consistent, more structured high press coupled with the high line, it would have been more effective. But essentially, they just allowed us to get over our I don't know if complacency is the right word, but just our lull in the little bit in that first part of the first half. We got over it and we got into our rhythm, and then it was basically over for them, because essentially Zidane didn't really do anything special. But what I did enjoy was that it was a fairly structured 4-4-2, in that players knew their roles, they played within those roles, and it all looked very nice as a team. So if you look at the heat maps, if you look at the pass map, it looks like a really nice balanced 4-4-2 with everyone playing within their roles. And I think BBC, they benefited from that kind of structure and that support. So Bale, I think he had 8 out of 11 dribbles. Benzema had 7 key passes. Ronaldo had 8 shots, 4 of which were on target. So they were just able to combine in the final third and just wreak havoc on Alaves. And Zidane just sat back and let that happen. And, you know, that's good enough. We beat Alaves 4-0, and I think I was just really happy with their performance and the way they worked within the context of the team.
I mean, it's certainly enough to against a team that was sort of struggling like Alaves. Obviously they turned around under Abelardo, but I think that when you get these guys firing, there are almost no defensive lines in the world that can contain them, and much less a Alaves defensive line that was struggling. And, you know, what was really interesting about this match, at least for me, was that if you actually, like, you know, looking at the kind of vast array of attacking talent on Real Madrid, everyone looked really good. This was not a game where essentially no one was struggling. And even players that had, you know, previously in the season kind of gone on and off a little bit, like Teo had good games. I mean, I thought Teo was one of the most, you know, the brightest lights of the match in a lot of circumstances. I mean, like, he lost the ball a couple of times, but I mean, he had that, he turned on that Teo from last season look that we'd seen only flashes of so far, and he had a pretty consistently solid game, I thought.
Teo was relative to what we've seen of Teo this season. Like, I'm trying to think back to stand-up performances from him, which haven't been many since he joined.
There have been a couple, but not, like, and more, like, I remember I've had to defend myself a lot with Teo just because, like, and this is not, trying to take a victory, like, because he could easily turn around and put up a clunker, but, like, just saying, like, he has all of the elements there that you want when you're, when you're talking about a long-term, you know, high-end a wing back, and it's like the power, the speed, the touch on the ball, like He's got it all. He's an absolutely elite prospect. We've seen him put it together, and this was a match where he put it together. That's basically what I'm saying. And like, we hadn't seen him put it together for a full match. I mean, maybe once or twice this year. That's it.
Right. No, I think the closest thing we saw was against Sociedad in Anoeta, where he, to me, I thought he got the better of Odriozola in that match. And it was a really fun back and forth duel between the two. And in this game, I think, like you mentioned, a couple of his touches, like within the span of like 3 minutes in the first half, there was a moment where he just kind of dribbled into two or three players. And then on the other end, he has a really heavy touch and can control a pass and Real Madrid concede a chance. But I think those are the things, like you even saw Gareth Bale dispossessed like 5 times in this game, and he also had a great game. And I think what we saw from Teo was, like, to your point, Gabe, also, is that he has all the tools to be a really, really good left back, and there's no reason he shouldn't be, considering his pace, his power, his strength, his ability to shoot. Cross, he is not all there yet, but he has the tools, right? And I think you saw, especially in the second half, where he would just carve through players, and then you're like, wow, this was like Alaves Teo showing up here.
Right, we didn't watch every Alaves match, so saying it's Alaves Teo, like, yeah, but he also put up some, like, clunkers at Alaves, too. Like, he wasn't coming out and just dominating every game like that when he was there, too. So, but what we did see is, like, him in kind of the vintage, the reason we all thought of him and think of him still as just this extremely elite prospect. Sorry, Ohm, go ahead.
I was just going to say that what I noticed with Teo was how, in addition to what you guys were saying, how just individually he looked better, he also seemed to understand his place within the team better, in the sense that he was on the same wavelength as everybody else, because in the past, he just didn't seem to know when to time his runs, when he should check his runs and let the winger next to him make that overlapping run, how to time his crosses, when he should take on players. And he just seemed very hesitant and uncertain. He didn't seem to know how to work in conjunction with the rest of the team. And I think versus Alaves, we saw him take that step where he understood basically how he was supposed to go about doing everything and how that worked in relation with the rest of the team. And so I think that's what allowed him to then put up really great numbers that showed how good his individual performance was, because he had 3 key passes. He had 5 dribbles completed, and he managed 2 shots on target. I mean, those are spectacular figures for a fullback, even an attacking fullback at Real Madrid. And I think that just goes to show how he's slowly maturing at Real Madrid. And I think that also shows why we need to have patience with young players like this, because if we go back and we look at players like Ramos and Marcelo, it's not like they came to Real Madrid and they just took off immediately. They had spells like this where they struggled to understand how they were supposed to work within different tactical schemes, and it took several seasons for them to get used to it and become the players that we know. And I think these sorts of games gives us reasons to be even more patient and give Teo time, because eventually he is going to be able to produce matches like this consistently. We just need to remember what the development process looks like.
Exactly. That's such an important thing to remember. And that's still true for, like, all of these young players. Like, even Asensio isn't always putting out that, like, vintage, absolute, like, world-beating form. No one is, other than they're like Cristiano and Messi, and we've gotten so obsessed with, you know, these two players and imagining we forget that what the world of sport really looks like, and these two guys are such world-beating gods. And, like, even when Cristiano was struggling, you know, that was such a shock to us, right? Because he's not a person who struggles. He's not anymore. And we expect now, like, him to go out and score once or twice every single game, the same with Messi all the time. So, like, but that's not really the way even the elite players play, like the humans. But even these young guys, like, we want them to go out and give a great performance every time. But, like, we have to be patient with them. And that's one of the things that, like, is really getting me with the way some of our fan bases, Real Madrid fan base, has reacted to some of these young players. Like, the depth is still there for this team, except for the fact that, part of the depth is a bunch of these young players and not these kind of veterans, right, who may be a little bit more consistent. Tian, we discussed this a little bit on the last show.
Yeah, because the problem with the way everything you both of you guys are saying is 100% correct. Like, there's no question, because we know the leash that certain fans have, and it's, and by the way, it's not just Teo who you know, we need to have patience. It's also have a longer leash with the veterans also, like with players like Marcelo, who are far from perfect every single game, and you kind of go down the list, and it's just no player is immune to having flaws and making mistakes. And again, like, this is, I think the most staggering thing about all this is the fact that winning and scoring goals masks so many of our problems, and it changes our tone completely. I don't know if it was the Patreon podcast we were talking about it, maybe with Ohm last week, but you all of a sudden you see Ram, maybe, I think it was Gabe actually, because we were talking about the ketchup bottle and stuff, and all of a sudden, the last 6-7 games, Real Madrid is surpassing their expected goals every single game. And so everything changes. The tone changes. Our expectations change. Our leash with the players change. The problems get masked. And then so we list the problems secondary. Whereas when we lose, we list the good things secondary. And I think that's just like kind of nature. Of the nature of our fan base, or probably every fan base, is that winning solves everything at this point. And
scoring solves everything.
I mean, you look at, like, the fans complain a lot about crosses and stuff, and we only 22 is might be a lot of crosses for the general, like, average team, but it's also, like, lower than our own average at home, especially. And everything in this game, a lot of it was emphasized on the flanks. Look at the heat maps, look at the pass maps, look at the emphasis of getting the ball to Varane and Teo, Teo and Carvajal, and then getting it up to Vasquez and Bale, and the movement in the final third was good. Kovacic and Casemiro would distribute it out wide. There wasn't much carving through the middle in the final third, and no one cared that we were crossing, because we were deadly. Like, we were deadly, right, in this game. And
when the ball was, like, and they're like on the various goals, it would go out wide, and then they would find someone in the middle who would either play it on or take a shot. I mean, like, it was, and it wasn't always like crosses in the air, it was also crosses, like, on the ground and all that, but it all counts sort of as a cross. And, like, I mean you're totally right, like, no one is, I didn't hear a single person saying we crossed, like, Real Madrid crossed the ball too much. Like, I didn't see that. I mean, it's possible people were saying that, but it would be a very minor nit to pick in this match where Madrid scored 4 goals and had quite a high expected goals too. So, like, one of the cool things about this also is that, yeah, we said that the expected goal stuff would even out. We said that all the goals would come, you know, the whole idea of the ketchup bottle is what I was saying. But, like, also, this isn't like a game where Madrid had, you know, scored 4 goals but only had, like, 1 expected goal. This is a game where Madrid had, you know, expected goals of, like, 2.8 plus a penalty. So, like, it was quite high.
Yeah. And I think, and by the way, I think the crosses thing, like, look, Real Madrid, when they play like this, it's very chaotic to deal with for a defensive line. And it's not like Alaves are this defensive juggernaut, but I think, like, we saw the chaos it brings even against a team like PSG. If they get it wrong, if they switch off or they play a high line, those crosses, like, those one-touch crosses that are low-driven on the ground that come from, like, Asensio and Bale, and Marcelo, we've seen do it often, like Benzema, those are so deadly. They can destroy teams. Yeah. And honestly, like, no one cares that we go to the flanks when we're creating that much danger, that level of danger. And when, like, for example, there's a question coming up about Lucas Vasquez. Like, the question is essentially from a patron who says, and we'll get into it, but he's asking, what has changed for Lucas in the past few games? Like, how simplistic would it be, but how correct would it be to be like, look, he just went into another gear? Like, all of these off-ball movements we're seeing from the team, some of the things that are getting fixed schematically, and you see the progression from the game against Betis, where we saw Casemiro and Kovacic together, and then you saw them together for the second time in a row, and then for the third time in a row. And in each game, the scheme changed a bit to benefit them. And those subtle changes changed the complexion of the game completely, because against Betis, the same 4-4-2 was getting overrun because Bale was in one of the advanced positions, he wasn't helping from deep, and he definitely wasn't helping on the left flank. And Kovacic and Casemiro, the whole team neither was horizontal or vertically compact. And then some of that got remedied in like a 4-2-3-1 the next game against Leganés. And then in this game, you put Bale on the left, Vasquez on the right, and they're both very intelligent two-way wingers. And
yep.
And things change. And Benzema is obviously not a pure nine. He's doing a lot of really good work from deep, as you saw in, on the play where he stole the ball and then he launched a counter and Bale scored. All of these things matter, and there's like progression and baby steps being taken, and these are just, I don't know why we don't see these things earlier in the season, but we see them now, and that's why kind of like we don't complain as much.
Definitely. I mean, and obviously that was the big problem this season, that Madrid didn't kick this gear on until the last couple of, this last month, basically. And that is a real problem. I mean, Madrid will not win La Liga now because of that. And they won't really even challenge for it. And if they, had been a little bit luckier, maybe they would be at least be able to challenge for it. But that's just the way this kind of season has crumbled. And, the Madrid's best shot is still the Champions League, and there are a lot of very good teams. So I think it's, despite like the good feelings now, it's very possible that this is a season that maybe ends with Madrid feeling okay about the way that they played in the second half of the season, but not good about the trophy haul, which is going to probably be fair. I wanted to go through a couple more performances that I had of note. I actually disagreed with some of Matt's player ratings, not in terms of ratings, but just in terms of like,
Cedric.
Yeah, for example,
Cedric.
Cedric. Ooh, Cedric. Sorry, yeah. My bad. Yeah. I thought Matt did. Well, I mean, he did the tactical.
They usually flip it, but this time they did it differently. Yeah.
So, we talked about Kovacic. I want to bring Kovacic up again. I thought he was extremely good. I thought, subtle but really command performance from him. And it's amazing, Keon, we talked about on the midweek show, but it's amazing that even a couple years ago we were thinking this kid is nothing, like we should loan him out. But he is just, every time he comes in, he just feels more and more like he is the actual heir apparent to Modric, and like he even plays like him.
It's crazy, again, like I'd be interested to hear what Om says too, but it's crazy how much different a player can look in just an adjusted scheme. And I thought against Betis, the reason why that double pivot really didn't work was for the reasons we've already mentioned a million times, so I don't want to rehash it, but it's just, you surround him with better players and in a tighter scheme, it's just better. And I think like one of the things that for example, the 4-2-3-1 against Leganés provided was you have defensive help because you have a packed midfield, and then you have creators offensively that can relieve some of the burden of creating through the middle. And in that game, like for example, Lucas Vazquez was really good, and Kovacic also stepped up, and he was a ball carrier in transition, but he also had good coverage if he ventured forward. And Bale and Lucas Vazquez both did a lot of work defensively in this game. And I think that's one of the things, like Lucas Vazquez might go unnoticed. Like he had a really good offensive game, but Alaves didn't threaten much. But I think one of the reasons why they couldn't was because their counterattacks consisted a lot of Sobrino or Pedraza going on the counter on that flank. And Vazquez completely shut them down. And he worked really hard off ball. And I think all those things matter. And the thing with Kovacic that it's important for him, I think, is that he needs to be involved. So one, like we saw Gareth Bale involved. He had the second most touches on the field and 7 dribbles. And that's the best version of Bale is alpha male Bale. We know that. But Kovacic also has been a funnel in the last 2 games with the ball in terms of bringing the ball in transition and binding the team together and having a lot of touches. And I think that is really important for him.
Yeah. So, what do you think? I mean, like, what has changed for us with him? I mean, like, obviously, like, he's become an absolutely essential player. Is this, you know, it's, and there's still room to grow here, right? Like, so I mean, did you have the same impression of him this match as we did?
So, yeah, I mean, I felt he had a very good game. He's, I think the most underrated quality of Kolačić is his ability to run with the ball. I think he completed 5 of 5 dribbles, and if you look at his dribble completion rate, he had the highest last season. I think it was around 80%, which is ridiculous for the amount that he dribbles. And this season, I'm sure it's as high as well. But I'm not as sure that the system changed that much from Betis to this match. I think it had more to do with the way Alaves approached this game in contrast to Betis. So I would agree with Kian that this scheme looked tighter. Like, this 4-4-2 looked tighter. It looked more organized. It looked better. But I think that had a lot to do with how Betis was a lot braver in the way they attacked us and how they controlled the game, and also the fact that they used positional play. And they basically consistently tried to create overloads everywhere. They manipulated our shape successfully. They dominated possession for large portions of that game. And they really made it difficult for us. And they outnumbered us in midfield with the narrow positioning of their wingers. And it's always tough if you're not going to press properly with the 4-4-2 and you're not going to be necessarily that organized. And I think that's why Kovacic and Casemiro looked overrun that game, as opposed to Alaves, where they didn't really press us and they allowed us to control the game. So I think that played a large part of it, because Alaves's, the passes per defensive action they allowed, or their passes per defensive action score was 12.54. So they allowed 12.5 passes per defensive action in our own half, as opposed to Betis, which was around 9. So that represents a big difference in one team that pressed very high and made it very difficult for Casemiro and Kovacic to play out from the back. And then Alaves, who sat a lot deeper and made things easier. But having said that, I do think Bale on the left flank as opposed to Asensio. So I like Asensio a lot. I think he's a hard worker, but Bale is simply a better two-way player on the flank. He provides more energy, and I think he because of his time in the game, he's a little smarter defensively. He provides more organization, and he's not as easily drawn out of position as Asensio can be. I think that played a role, but I do think it has more to do with the opposition than necessarily our scheme changing that much to benefit Kolačić and Casemiro.
Well, that makes sense to me. Casemiro, yeah, another solid game, shows what he does. I would have liked to see him come off a little earlier. I was going to say, like, yanking Casemiro in the late, you know, maybe 83, I think he came off for Llorente.
Marcos, it's a little mind-boggling.
He needs more minutes. Like, they could have done a double substitution when Ceballos came on in minute 73. So let's quickly talk about our two very wonderful adult children, Ceballos and Llorente. Ceballos finally getting some good minutes. That's really wonderful. I thought he actually looked really good when he played, too.
The Ceballos thing might be better passed on to Ohm, because that's key immediate reaction writing time for me. So usually those late subs, okay, I feel like I want to pass it along to someone who analyzes it.
That's fair. What did you think? I my read was actually that he was better and more involved than I'd seen him in a couple appearances, not including obviously the incredibly annoying 30 seconds against Leganés.
I mean, I think that's fair. I think the game was fairly dead by the time he came on, so it was a little easier for him. But I think you could see that he came on feeling like he had a point to prove, because there was all that drama about him getting literally less than 30 seconds of playing time and not even touching the ball in the last match. And then Zizou came out and apologized. And I think Ceballos very much still wants to prove to Zidane and prove to everyone that he deserves minutes in the squad. And I think you could see that in his performance. I mean, I don't know if you can pick out anything that was super special, but I personally could see purpose in his play and some desire, which is good considering how he hasn't really gotten a lot of minutes over the season. So it's good to see that. Good to see that he still has some of that hunger.
Absolutely.
And I hope going forward we can give him more minutes in the league.
Hell yeah. And Llorente only had like 6 minutes on the pitch. So
yeah, he should have gotten more.
Got to get him in earlier. And like you see with Teo, like obviously he was forced into it, but he's been growing up and he's growing into the season. And I think that, you know, these matches like this, I mean, like I thought he's been really, really solid last couple games, but this is a very strong match for him. And, you know, that's the kind of progression that you're looking for when you start giving players more minutes. But if the minutes are random and sporadic, only a certain type of player is really going to be able to continue to progress and show off every single time he gets minutes. So, like, you know, there were a couple games earlier in the season where Ceballos actually played really well. He started from the beginning, et cetera. And then he just had this big chunk of time where he basically didn't play. And then he came back and he just wasn't, you know, didn't quite show off every time he was on the pitch, which is bad. And, you know, obviously Asensio was kind of the opposite. Like, he was, you know, always looking really good when he got minutes. And then Teo, like, when he finally got minutes, he's grown up with it. So, like, I just wish that Zidane just, like, I know that's a bit of a ramble, but what I mean is every player has a different developmental curve and what they require is different. So obviously Asensio maybe didn't need, you know, to get tons of minutes to show that he was who we all thought he was. But Ceballos maybe actually would need to get full games to grow into the game or to get at least a half or like 30 solid minutes, which is almost what he got this time. I mean, he got 20 or so. And, you know, that's, I would hope that Zidane sees that and understands that if he's going to develop this kid to be a go-to player, that's what he needs to give him, because he just can't otherwise. And I think Llorente is sort of the same way. Like, I really like when he's on the pitch. I like him a lot, but not, you know, it's obviously not like, it's not going to work if they keep not playing him or playing. It's hard to bring in a center midfield, like center defensive midfield, to play for 5 minutes. Like, that's not, you know, that's not a position that lends itself easily to just being a late game sub.
I just, like, with that whole position, it's been such a huge talking point. And it's been a talking point all season. And it was a talking point when we signed him. I remember all the discussions, all the questions, the articles I wrote about Kovacic and Ceballos and stuff. Like,
what's her name who keeps literally asking every single
yes,
show?
Yes, the beloved soul who asks us every single week about their playing time. The answer remains the same every week, by the way.
Same answer.
That Llorente, look, we had this concern. We knew that he was probably going to be a third choice defensive midfielder. I thought, you know, he would squeeze in a second, but the reality is Casemiro, Kroos, maybe even Kovacic. Oh, sorry, Casemiro, Kovacic, and then maybe even Kroos as a third choice DM. And that's fine. But with Ceballos, you were really like, we didn't lose any depth in that position, and then we added it. And even when we didn't add, it was tough for Kovacic to break in. Now you add one more. And Gabe, we talked about this on the Patreon podcast. If this was the idea all along, if Zidane knew there was a 10% chance that Ceballos wouldn't break through the team, why bring him? And I did also mention, and just so sorry for the patrons who already heard me say this, but for the non-patrons, when I was discussing this with David Cartledge earlier in the season, who was connected to Betis, he said that they were completely open to taking Ceballos back on loan after Real Madrid signed him. And
we should have done it.
If we knew that was on the table and we knew that Ceballos was just not going to play, why didn't we do that?
It doesn't make sense. No, in all seriousness, it doesn't make sense otherwise. I think the only, like, as we discussed, the only, like, thing they must have thought was that he would break in and get serious run. That's the only explanation, because otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not like he hasn't had the chance, right? Because we've had injuries. We've had suspensions. There's been opportunities. It's not like every single person has been healthy and
right now is an opportunity. I'm correct. Like, let's be clear. Like, we have Modric and Kroos are both injured. This is like literally what he's should be playing for. And like, nope. Instead, Zidane is rolling out a lineup including Kovacic, Casemiro, and Lucas Vazquez in Bale in mid, or like a 4-4-2 or 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1. And none of these lineups include Ceballos, which is mind-boggling.
And also, is Casemiro really that exciting in a double pivot? Like, he went up and did a bunch of things against Leganés, but I know we all know that's not sustainable. Nor do we want to see him there.
Extremely eye-rolling. Like, why, if you're going to have a double pivot and have Casemiro be basically your extra offensive player when you want to overrun, like, what the hell? Why not just bring in Ceballos to play that position? Ugh.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that when Modric and Kroos goes down, Zidane decides to opt for the 4-4-2 instead of sticking with his preferred three-man midfield. And because a three-man midfield would, with Modric and Kroos out, allow Ceballos to play. So if you think about it, Casemiro, Llorente at defensive midfield, and then Kovacic and Ceballos as the interiors, that sounds pretty good to me. But I think it's interesting that Zidane, I mean, we've had the 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1 in three straight games now. And to me, that speaks to the fact that I think that Zidane doesn't really trust Ceballos for whatever reason, because we could easily play a three-man midfield. It's not like the Modric and Kroos injuries have forced us away from that. And considering we're going to play the three-man midfield when they come back, it would provide better continuity to stay within that system and give Ceballos minutes within it. And so the fact that he isn't doing that maybe tells me that he doesn't really trust Ceballos that much. And I don't know what to say to that, because, you know, Zidane sees Ceballos in training. Maybe he sees something that we don't, but I just know what I saw with Ceballos at Betis. I know with the little bright spots I've seen him this season that as tough as it is to integrate him in the squad, I do feel that he's deserved more minutes than he's gotten.
And he's got to be, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's got to be something else, but I mean, like, there's also this belief, I think, that Zidane has Lucas Vázquez is just an absolute rock for him, and he just goes back to that well a lot. And, like, recently it's been coming up really well for him. But, like, as you said, a totally regular and normal formation could be a 4-3-3 with Kovacic and Casemiro next to each other. Kovacic and Ceballos next to each other, playing in the Kroos-Modric role and Casemiro in his defensive mid role, and then with the BBC up front. That is absolutely something that they could roll with. But instead, it's been, you know, let's bring in Lucas Vázquez. Let's make sure, you know, Asensio is being played in a 4-2-3-1, 4-4-2, and instead of, like, rolling with a 4-3-3, which it's not like he doesn't have the players for, is basically what you're saying, right?
I think... Yeah, and it's...
Go ahead,
Go ahead, Keon. I was just going to say that it's tough, right? Because like you said, Gabe, he's also tried to ensure that Asensio's playing. And it's not like you can blame Zidane for playing Lucas Vázquez when Lucas Vázquez has had his best stretch of form these past couple of games. I mean, over the past five games, he has 5 assists and 2 goals. I mean, those are really good numbers. And I can't criticize Zidane for playing Lucas. It could be that it's just tough because Zidane has to juggle all of these players, and in the process he's just decided that Ceballos is expendable. But I also think there could be a trust issue there. I mean, it's really hard to say. I mean, I don't want to pretend like any of my conclusions are definitive here. I mean, I'm throwing out some guesses here.
Yeah.
Well,
no, totally.
I think in a lot of ways we tend to compare different players who Zidane will look at and say these are completely different players positionally and they bring different things to the table. So, you know, like someone like Lucas Vázquez is a completely different player than Ceballos, and the dimension that he brings is obviously completely different, and Zidane likes the idea that he's an amazing... I don't know, maybe an amazing is a stretch, but he's a very good, very solid winger who can defend and he works hard without the ball. He's able to kind of carry forth this vision of getting the ball to the flanks and hugging the flank and linking up with the fullbacks and whatever. And I think Ceballos is a type of player who is best suited when he doesn't have defensive duties. So, like, we categorize him as a center midfielder, but I'm not even sure if Zidane sees him as a player who should be as deep as Kovacic even. So I think in a lot of ways, Ceballos competes more with someone like Isco or Asensio. who can play centrally if needed and be more versatile and not be deeper. So not playing a double pivot and not play like a Copa. Like you've seen when Ceballos like has started games, like in the Copa del Rey, he'll have Llorente and then Kovacic and then Ceballos, like an, as kind of like the spearhead, but he's a bit interchangeable with Kovacic, but he's not doing many defensive duties. And while I think he can do that, I think this is why we don't see him that much, is because Zidane doesn't want to see him that deep. And when you're competing with Isco, you're probably in maybe in a tougher spot, if that makes sense. Again, if this was the situation, why did we? I feel like when we brought him, he came out of the blue because we were like, oh, where is he going to play? But also, he came out of the blue at a time where Barca seemed close to signing him.
Yeah.
And
Barca also wanted him.
And if he had gone to Barca, he would have. At the time, we didn't have hindsight, right? So we didn't know Paulinho was going to work out. We didn't know Valverde was.
Shout out to Paulinho for like really putting in one of the worst performances of the season in their Champions League match against.
Yes, hopefully those duds continue. But like we all thought, like if they got Ceballos, this is one guy who can really upgrade their
instant upgrade. Yeah.
Instant upgrade, right?
And this is exactly why I'm not a fan of basing some of your transfer policy around preventing other teams from signing players, because. No matter, you can't, Barcelona will always be able to sign quality players no matter how much you want to play this game. All you can do is just focus on your needs and looking at fulfilling it. I mean, the reason we got rid of James, who Ceballos replaced, is because James wasn't getting enough minutes. And we've discussed this over, people ask why did James leave, and it's as simple as that. James wasn't content with the minutes he was getting, so he left and went to Bayern. And so, from that perspective, James was actually surplus to requirements. We didn't need another central midfielder to come in and replace James. And yet we did it with Ceballos because, like Kian was saying, Barca were interested in him and we couldn't let that happen. And while I think you can argue and say, well, Barca probably would have been better. I mean, so what are we going to do next season? So next season, Barca sees another talented young central midfielder and they want to purchase him. Do we purchase that central midfielder as well and make our depth problems even greater? I mean, it's just not a sustainable form of transfer business. And I don't think it's something that we should continue to do if that was the reason we signed Ceballos in the first place.
This is where I find the NBA system, where they have the G League and NBA teams have like a secondary team in a lower league where they can stockpile a bunch of talented players and get them to play week in, week out, game in, game out. That kind of system kind of lacks in Spanish football. And it'd be impossible.
We have Castilla, though.
Yeah, I know. But Castilla is also in third division. So you can't sign Ceballos and put him in third division. But it would be also impossible to do unless you bought another club like City did with Girona. So it'd be nice to have something like that just cause to get them like playing all the time, you know. That I told Gabe last week on the Patreon pod, I really like the way we're handling Odegaard right now. Like, there's no rush with him. We got him out of Castilla. He's playing every single game. He's improving every single game. He's making leaps. Perfect. Just, we've been patient with him. He's playing. I think that system should be replicated, you know, with other players if we have them. Like, it made sense with Thierry, with Fede Valverde. Unfortunately, he's not really playing and now he's injured. But, if the loan option was available for either Ceballos and Llorente, and we knew this was the situation this year, I'll be honest, we messed up.
Yeah. Let's go on to, let's answer some questions because we've been, you know, good riff on this stuff. Interesting conversation, but I think it's time, unless you guys have any points you wanted to make that aren't related to our conversation we're about to have.
This is the most we've ever answered this question about Ceballos and the playing time. So
yeah. Okay. So yeah. What's your name? Whatever your name is, this, please listen to this conversation. We just literally just answered your question. We didn't even read it. This is the answer to your question. You ask us every week from like five dummy accounts.
Oh, shit.
All right. Mark Reedy asks us, another strong game from Kovacic. We've seen an in-form Lucas look unstoppable on the right. What has been the main reason for this form? Also, props for Ronaldo making a good captain's call on the pen. So let's really quickly talk about the Ronaldo thing. So last goal, Ronaldo could have gotten his hat trick. Instead, he chooses to give the ball to Benzema. Really classy move from Ronaldo, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think everyone thought that.
He was also, if he had scored that penalty, he would have moved ahead of Messi in the total goals across all competitions, which I'm sure they keep track of because they're that competitive. But I think it just speaks to how much Ronaldo values Benzema as a partner on the pitch, because there's a lot of, I mean, Ronaldo fans, or Ronaldo fanboys, I should say, are particular culprits when it comes to criticizing and hating on Benzema because, you know, the narrative that Ronaldo would have like 100 assists a season if it wasn't for Benzema missing his chances all the time. But, you know, Ronaldo obviously doesn't see it that way. I think the penalty is that he gave Benzema is just a very, very visible appreciation of what Benzema brings. But there's also several other times in the past where Ronaldo has spoken up about Benzema's quality. How when Benzema made that backheel assist to Ronaldo, Ronaldo pointed at Benzema to ask the fans to clap for him. How Ronaldo's gotten angry at the fans for whistling Benzema when he misses chances. I mean, say what you want about Benzema's form over the past two seasons, and I think we all know that he's declined as a player. His legacy as a player will be one that enhanced everyone else across the pitch, especially Ronaldo. Yeah. And Ronaldo, a player who definitely has an ego, if he's out there basically openly appreciating Benzema and what Benzema does to improve his own game, I think we should take that as pretty much fact as Benzema's legacy.
Yeah, I agree.
We should really respect that.
And it's part of, like, keeping Ronaldo, like, invested and happy. And, like, this is a player, Benzema, who's grown up as a player next to the greatest Real Madrid player in history, arguably, and that's amazing. And he's tailored his game to play next to Ronaldo. And, you know, I mean, it's almost 10 years that Benzema has been with him. If you look back, that's a huge amount of time. And I mean, players' careers a lot of the time last less than 10 years. So, you know, he's been playing at this top level of football for only maybe 13 years, and Logan is very much invested in Kareem. But it's amazing, and Ronaldo has in part tailored his game to the evolution of Benzema and the people that have been next to him. And I think you're totally right that the legacy he will leave when he leaves Real Madrid is one of a consummate a creator and someone who. It's like I don't know if you guys play video games, but they're characters in lots of video games whose entire role is to basically run around and like make other players like make other characters better, and like that's sort of what Benzema does.
This whole discussion about Ronaldo is the most underrated part of when everyone asks why do we have Benzema? It's like because the greatest player of all time has a say. That's why. Like that's a huge factor.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't. So you know what? We didn't even really talk about Karim other than what we just brought him up now. But Benzema
was worth talking about.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
He had 7
key rules,
passes.
Man. He was awesome. Yeah. He was incredible. And that assist on the first goal was absolute sex. It was beautiful, yeah. Incredible. It's so cool to see the BBC play and play well together. I mean, we know they're really good. I mean, just it's amazing how the dialogue in this game changes so fast. But like, just even a couple months ago, we were like talking about how this team is not even, you know, in the best in the world. But like, when these guys are firing, they are the elite striking force in the world. There's no one who's as good as the three of them. I would put them up against literally any other group. So
it will be interesting to say. I know we're kind of deviating from the question, which was about Kovacic, but just quickly, I think it's interesting to. I do like the idea that while BBC was great, it was kind of the front four, and Lucas Vazquez was very much a part of this, and it wasn't really a 4-3-3 as we know. Bale was on the left flank. It was four attacking players, and Kovacic also
was 4-2-4 sort of.
And Zidane seemed to hint after the game, because he mentioned the front four, and someone asked him if we'll see Bale on the left against PSG, and Zidane said that he actually put Bale on the left in this game because he wanted to see how he would work there. So I don't know if that was kind of foreshadowing.
Amazing. Like, maybe we should play the player who is actually a left winger on the left wing. Like, that's literally, whatever.
Yeah.
It probably is foreshadowing. Like, we've been talking about Keon, and all of us have been mentioning how the game in the in Paris is going to require a solid and structured defensive response, and then the ability to break hard and open the pitch up when we have the ball, and that's just screaming out for a player like Bale and, you know, real solid winger. So I think it's very possible we'll have Bale and have him say, Bale, you need to play as a winger and not just as a floater.
Mm. Yeah.
So
yeah. But I think going back to, like, really, really early in the podcast when Ohm was making the point that Betis attacked us differently than Alaves did, I think one of the underrated things would be if, like, you know, PSG are obviously even way better at attacking than either of those teams. And especially if Neymar plays, we don't know if he will because we just heard about his injury. But we also just can't discount what Bale brings to the table defensively. Kovacic, yeah, how about Kovacic? What was the question?
Yeah, we've already answered this sort of. What's the reason? Why are these guys playing well? I mean,
okay.
You know, we've sort of already talked about that. I tweeted out a graphic about this, where if you actually looked at the kind of average player position, like where Ronaldo was receiving passes, where Benzema, where Bale, they were all kind of on the left side of the pitch. And so I said, you know, look, there's a reason that Lucas Vazquez was receiving the ball in space so much. And it's partially because these guys were playing and interchanging really well together on the left, but just generally playing really close and well with each other. But also because, like, when you have that type of Benzema, Bale, and Ronaldo combining really well together on one side of the pitch, your defense, like, your instinct is to kind of shuffle everyone over. So whenever Lucas could receive these long, like, switch in plays, or even when Real Madrid would move the ball quickly across the pitch back, he would receive a ball and be able to run at a defense that was trying to rush back to get into position to play against someone who, again, he wasn't straying from his winger position. He was a right winger, and he wasn't going to receive the ball anywhere other than the right wing, basically.
Yeah, and he did so much defensive work. I think that was one thing that I mentioned quickly, but Sobrino, Pedraza, these guys just really struggled to on counterattacks because Lucas Vazquez was always there working really hard. And that's a big asset.
Yep. Joao dos Santos says, out of all this season's summer signings, who do you think has seemed most promising? I know people have criticized him, but I think Teo has played very well. Most promising, I mean, the summer signings were Teo, Ceballos, like the actual signings, right? Not Llorente, not Vallejo. We're not counting Vallejo. I think we should count Vallejo.
I would, just because it makes it easy, right? Because then Vallejo is the most promising.
Yeah, for me, Vallejo is the most promising. He is, if he can figure out his injury issues, he is an all-timer. I think he'll be a Real Madrid lifer, like... I mean, like, everything that you see from him is already elite. Like, he's young, he's extremely exciting, and he's already elite, right? Teo, we talk about as a prospect because he has to improve on a couple aspects of his game and make sure that he can do it consistently. Vallejo, not a problem for me. I would be happy to play him when he's healthy. I'd play him against literally anyone.
Agreed.
I'm not sure if I have anything to add to that. I was trying to think back who are our summer signings, and you guys actually had to remind me. But Vallejo, on his day, he's, even at this age, you can tell he's going to be a generational defender. We just need him to stay healthy, and that's the bottom line. I mean, and the rest, in terms of, like, performance this season. Obviously, we just don't really have sample size with Ceballos and Llorente. Like, we just go by based on what we've seen from them last season. I will say about Ashraf, I would never put him in this conversation of most promising, like, in terms of, like, where Vallejo is. But I will just quickly say that he's surprised me in some ways, because I really thought he was raw, and I think he is still really raw. But I think what he surprised me was not the fact that he hasn't really been good offensively, but defensively his IQ is much higher than I gave him credit for previously. Yeah, and I think that the fact that he's good defensively and understands things defensively and has pace gives me some hope on him.
Oh, yeah. I was going into this season, I wasn't sure that Ashraf would even be a... Like, I thought he would be, like, maybe a competent and, you know, long-term La Liga player. Like, he'll play. Like, that's... And that, I remember when I interviewed Morientes a couple years ago, and he was at that time coaching one of Madrid's youth teams.
When was this?
Teams.
When? How come I didn't know about this?
This was back in... Josh and I talked to him. It was back in before the death he went. That was okay. Was in law school. Okay. But yeah, so we talked to him, and he, what I asked him was like, well, who do you see being really good? Like, what about, do you have anyone that you're keeping your eye on, or that we should keep our eyes on, right? And he was like, I think that there are a number of players who will be professional, and like that actually, you know, is actually basically what you're looking for at that age, and that's great. And because of course I was like, oh, is there anyone like who's a world-class star? And you know, he's not going to choose anyone like that, but I used to think that Ashraf, like, that's sort of where he was, he's going to be a professional. And now I think that he could be a Real Madrid player. I didn't think that, because he has these level of, you're right, Keon, defensive instincts that you can, it's very hard to teach, and actually you can work with a player and teach them how to do better crosses. Like, I feel like that is definitely something you can learn and have better, like, offensive, just literal technical ability. It's interesting, because when we saw him, we kind of both expected him to be more of a better offensive player, but actually he showed incredibly strong defensive instincts, and he seems very teachable. So I have actually higher hopes for him now than I did when the season started.
Right, and I think those things, actually a lot of them have to do with confidence, because a lot of the things he's struggling with offensively, it's just beating his man, dribbling past his man, putting in a good cross. And the things he's excelling at take less confidence to do, whereas just knowing where to be, working hard, just being able to put in a good challenge or keeping his man in front of him defensively. And then I think the rest of that stuff would come with better confidence.
I think so. I mean, the crossing, I mean, some of it really is technical, right? Like, it just, yeah. It's literally like working with the coaches and just hitting 1,000 of these fucking crosses and like getting your accuracy down. Like,
or knowing, you know, this, if it's a cutback, it's a cross, what
right,
is it?
What type of cross you're looking for, who the right player to put it to is. Right now, it just feels like he's kind of hammering it and he's not picking out a player he's trying to hit it to, which, like, he's maybe trying to generally get into the center of the area. And like, that's not the level we need, like, at Real Madrid. Like, he needs to be picking out an individual run that he's looking to hit, you know? Speaking of that, just really off topic, there was one moment in this game really bummed me out, when Bale played this beautiful lofted cross, and Ronaldo, if he had done the stupid, that shot from Van Persie in the World Cup in 2012, or 2014 World Cup, where he got that same lofted cross, but instead of what Ronaldo did, would just jump to try to head it, he dove. He would have scored. I was so sure of it. Speaking of great crosses. But yeah, so let's take a couple of non-guaranteed questions. Just really quickly, Jihan Watson asked us basically just another goalkeeper question. Donnarumma, Kepa, and De Gea, who would you want? This isn't a who would you want question. Oh, no. So then I think instead of, it's a probability question. I'm not going to give an answer to that. I don't really have one. I think De Gea, but I actually, just really quickly, there were some numbers that were floating around about De Gea, Kian, and Ohm. I'm sure you saw this, where it showed basically how many saves De Gea made versus like his expected number of saves in the
It was like
the
19
same
and 33 or something.
And it was unfathomable. Like, it was incredible. And And what he also did was there was another, you know, set of numbers that popped up, which where they, I think the numbers were basically like they had a league average percentage, and then he just like the numbers of like percent above league average he was, and
he that destroyed it.
Unbelievable. Like, so in baseball, we actually have a statistic that talks about league average a lot. And you can really see how good a player is, you know, and how much better or whatever, and how useful he is based on that stat. And it's basically any stat that ends with the symbol of plus. And that means that league average is 100, 50 is 50% worse than league average, and 150 would be 50% higher. De Gea is about a 140, so 40% better than league average, whereas Thibaut Courtois, the second best keeper in the Premier League, was 120. That is just a vast, vastly good season for De Gea. He is probably right now the best keeper in the world, I think.
Yeah, I've been So I've been trying to keep track of Man United at least a little bit, because there's players on that squad that I just like personally. For example, Anthony Martial or Martial or however you pronounce his name. He's a player like personally I just like a lot. And one thing I've noticed is like there's this narrative, right, that whenever Mourinho's team nicks like a 1-0 win or a 2-1 win, it's like Mourinho must have put in his classic defensive masterclass where he sat deep and they defended really well and they didn't allow a lot of chances. When in fact, whenever that's happened, it's been the defensive organization actually being poor, the defensive tactics not being that great, and De Gea just pulling out like 35 million saves a game, and like with half of them being just absolutely extraordinary. And he in many ways has kept Man United's season alive, especially if you guys saw the Europa League match against Sevilla, I think it was. De Gea made several crucial saves that Champions League. I've been used to Manchester United being in the Europa League for so long. So, yeah, it was a Champions League game, and Sevilla completely outclassed Manchester United, and it ended 0-0 because De Gea was just that good. And I was really disappointing because I thought Sevilla had a great chance to pick up a lead going to Old Trafford, but simply because of one guy who just wouldn't allow a goal in, it didn't happen. So, to go to like Jahan Watson's question, the probability is really difficult to say. So I don't know about the Donnarumma situation. I kind of lost track of that. But I do. Last I heard, the AC Milan fans still hated him for the whole contract situation, and they put like they held banners saying like just asking him to leave, and Donnarumma was in tears. But that was several months ago. So I don't know how that's affected him. The Kepa thing, all I know is we were supposed to get him in the winter transfer window and Zidane said no. So I honestly don't know. I mean, I think as long as Zidane is here, we stick with Navas. I don't know. Zidane just has a weird affection for Navas, and I like Navas a lot. But for example, the Betis game, like Navas made a bunch of good saves, and then he, on the Nacho own goal, he let in a shot that was fairly close to his body, and he inexplicably let it slip through him, and then it was Nacho made a mistake. It was an own goal, and that sums up Navas' season. I mean, he's done that so many times this season where he'll make a lot of good saves, and then he'll make one mistake, and it's, I mean, I guess you can say, oh, he made a lot of good saves, so we'll forgive him for that, which, you know, I'm not opposed to, but that's not world class. It wasn't what we saw from Navas in 2015-16 when he was off the charts good. And that's why I didn't understand why we said no to Kepa, because Kepa is also a fantastic keeper. So I think as long as Zidane is here, I don't think we're getting another keeper. But if Zidane goes, which is a likely possibility if we don't win the Champions League, then I really don't know, because I feel like we've lost our chance of getting De Gea with the fax machine thing.
I don't think that's true. I don't think so. I think that Madrid is going to go in on him this season, this summer. That's my feeling. I've been like, just if you're reading the tea leaves here, the Kepa, the not signing Kepa thing, which was a fucking gimme. It would have been the easiest signing ever, and it's such a fucking gimme, and I'm still annoyed about it. The fact that they decided not to do that means there's got to be a reason they decided not to do that. The only explanation is that they're. There's going to be some coordinated effort to try to get De Gea or Courtois this summer. I think it's one of those two. And I don't think it's Donnarumma. I think it's one of those two. I think Florentino wants the absolutely elite of the elite keepers. And he doesn't probably – I don't think they feel that Kehler is quite there anymore.
I like that theory. I like that theory.
I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, I haven't been.
Unless they were totally irrational and just decided not to get Kepa because they're stupid, which is also a possibility.
I mean, I just haven't been tracking this as much. So, I mean, what you're saying could be completely correct.
Here's the stat, by the way. I was
tracking the fucking Kepa stuff, but and there's also a lot of smoke about around these two keepers, and this seems like the year they're going to try to go for it. That's just my instinct. It's just because, guys, like the Kepa thing was a fucking nonsense. It was a
I don't understand it at all. Yeah.
It was the easiest. Like I'm mind boggling. It's the second time, Keon. By the way, this is the second time we've like already done, you know, talked about how much we like someone and like, oh, this is already signed. This is going to happen. All this stuff, Mbappe. And then the person didn't come. Him and Mbappe. This is the second time in like 6 months this happened to us. We have to just stop relying on these reports. But it's infuriating. They're both gimmies. The Mbappe thing, I think they really thought he was going to come. By the way, that's another thing. That or they're just stupid, and that's another option also. So last question.
Can I just interject really quickly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry. So I want to say something about Kepa really quick. The probability, but this is the stat about De Gea. That you were mentioning. So he's conceded 19 Premier League goals. This was before the Chelsea game today. So 20 now. Based on Opta XG data, for the shots on target he's faced, the average goalkeeper would have expected to concede 33 goals, which is the biggest differential by any goalkeeper in the league. Om already mentioned his saves against Sevilla, and he's had various games and saves this season where I was just like, wow, what the hell? How did he save that? That was a 100% goal. And Om like took the words right out of my mouth about Manchester United, because if you look at the way they're set up defensively, they set up defensively, but they're not actually defending well. And there's a lot of holes. And De Gea basically makes them look way better than they actually are defensively. And to me, like the comparison I drew, and I mentioned this on Twitter, was 2005 Casillas, where Real Madrid just could not defend for the life of them, and they also just had no midfield, and Casillas was single-handedly like keeping them in a respectable position in the league. And this is like kind of what we're seeing from De Gea right now. He's like a one-man defensive line, and it's actually unbelievable to watch him play. And I don't care what the probability is, if he's on the table for whatever, just get him. And Donnarumma, I don't know. I hate the idea of dealing with Raiola at any cost. He's probably the most annoying and worst thing that's ever happened to this earth. And Kepa, I think the probability of him is super low, not only because what Gabe just mentioned, that we could have had him for peanuts and we didn't, and we obviously just are not enamored with him. But also Bilbao, after they signed, they raised his buyout to 80, 85 million or something.
Which would be enough to get a lot. I mean, like that much money is probably enough to get Courtois too. I mean, especially if he doesn't sign a new contract before the season ends. I think it's around the same. Like, it's around the same probably to get De Gea. I mean, he's the type of person that comes in, and Kaylor's good, but this is like transcendent the way he's playing right now. So last question. I'm just going to do Nas's. Shout out to Nas Ryan yet. Jones. It's basically the same question.
Where you been, Nas?
Yeah, man, where you been? So who do you start basically in PSG? Do you start the BBC or Isco basically? This is a pretty quick question, I think. So what do you guys think? How do you line up in this PSG match? I think I've already tipped my hand a little bit, but be interested to hear your points.
You go.
I mean, BBC. I've been pretty consistent with this opinion because I don't know. Zidane's been doing the 4-4-2 a lot, so I guess Isco, if it's in a 4-4-2, flat 4-4-2, would be the worst thing in the world. But I was not happy to see the Diamond versus PSG in the first leg. I mean, it turned out being all right, but I don't think Emery coached that game well, and I don't think PSG took advantage of the holes of the diamond that like basically every other team has this season. So I mean, I wouldn't take that risk. I mean, it's possible that we play Isco there and we're fine, but then you're dropping one of the BBC who have just really hit their stride in the past couple of weeks, and I just don't see why you do that. I think it's perfect with the 3-1 lead going into the match to set up in a medium block and look to counter against PSG, who are susceptible to transitions and are going to really have to attack and look for goals. And I think that's the perfect way to do it. And, you know, you can't leave Ronaldo out of a Champions League match. I mean, that's just simply out of the question. Bale is the fastest player on the squad, or the fastest attacker we have. And then I would keep Benzema in there because, you know, he's looked good the past couple of games, and he enhances Ronaldo's play. And I don't like playing Ronaldo and Bale without Benzema. So that's how I would line up. And that's how I felt for the past month, 2 months or so, thinking about this matchup.
If it's one or the other, to me, it's BBC. But I don't know why Zidane still hasn't really figured out or not shown interest in playing BBC and Isco together, which is not...
Yeah, because if Modric and Kroos are out, Isco can play in that central midfield role. He proved under Ancelotti that he's good enough there and that he's disciplined there. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to seeing Isco and Kovacic and Casemiro playing there. I mean, that would be kind of exciting, in my opinion.
Yeah, I thought, you know, for what it's worth, I thought Isco was really good in the first leg against PSG, and his pressing really set the tone in that game. And you can say all you want that the game changed with Asensio and all this, and kind of use that as your argument to say Isco is not conducive to Real Madrid winning games. But the dynamic obviously changed at a time where Emery was also making brain farts, tactical brain farts, substitution brain farts. And those subs from Zidane were genius, and Asensio, Vasquez, Bale completely changed the game. But I think... I don't know if BBC and Isco are, it's particularly Bale and Isco, I don't know if there's a stat on how many times we've actually seen them together, but I feel like it hasn't been that many. And I don't know if it's because he feels that they would occupy the same area, or if he wants to put Bale on the left and Isco can't really play on the right, or he just likes the dimension of Lucas Vasquez and Asensio playing a bit wider. I don't know why he hasn't really been a fan of playing them both together.
I think it's because he doesn't see Isco as a central midfielder like Ancelotti did, which I don't understand. But we know that with Zidane's preference for Lucas Vasquez, that Zidane likes players in more traditional positions, which is why I think James struggled to get so much time, because Zidane refused to play him as a central midfielder. And I mean, I basically think that's it. And if that's the case, right, then usually Modric and Kroos keeps Isco out. And then, therefore, the only way for Isco to get in there is to play as an attacking midfielder, as a number 10, or on the left. And he won't play on the left because Ronaldo's there. So only when Bale's out, then does Isco get a chance to play. And, I mean, it's a bit odd. I mean, I understand, in a sense, why Zidane does it. But I think Isco proved himself under Ancelotti that he can play in a deeper and more restricted role and be very, very effective there.
I mean, I think in a weird way, we may not know the answer to this in terms of what's going to happen until the day of, because we thought we knew in the first leg and we were wrong. And maybe Zidane just was like, okay, well, that worked. Just control the game. We're winning by 2 goals. Let's just keep the ball. And then PSG obviously are going to push up like crazy in the second half. And then Bale and Asensio will come in and rip them on the counter. That's one way he might look at it.
That's sort
like
of...
we said before, we have no idea what Zidane is. we're just guessing, really.
Yeah. All right. Well, that sort of wraps up the show for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back. So next week, we've got obviously our patron show. Keon, you're going to do another show with Jonathan Johnson to preview PSG. Do we have anything else we want to plug, guys? Oh, let's do patron shout-outs. Sorry.
Patron shout-outs. Okay. Well, while I'm just digging up the list, I'll just quickly plug something because my mind was too tired to plug it in the last podcast. But tomorrow, so on the 26th, we're recording a Churros y Tácticas podcast with David Garrido and Diego Lorin. So send questions to my Twitter if you want. And also, I'm writing a really huge article on Raul, which is going to be big, but I don't know when I'm going to release it. Gabe, do you want to plug anything while I pull this up?
Evan and I have our show coming out hopefully tonight, maybe tomorrow, we talk about a lot of all the stupid stuff that came out that people were saying on soccer this week. So amazing. Sepp Blatter decided that he wanted to weigh in on where the World Cup should be in 2026, which is, for whatever reason, he thought that was something he wanted to talk about. We obviously... Oh, actually, what I really want to plug is, if you haven't listened to it yet, go listen to our show last week where we talked to Jess about Marco Asensio and his phantom woman who was stalking him. It was awesome. It's Audra and Marco. You can find that on Let's Pick Football, on ballondorder.com. You can go there. You can find us on iTunes. But it's quite a story, and to the point where we found out that something that like the jokes we were making about it had filtered their way back all the way to Marco himself, and he heard about this shit and then blocked this woman on Twitter, so, or on Instagram, which is hilarious. So yeah, check that out. It's quite funny.
You have anything to plug before I read Patreon shoutouts?
Nope, I don't got anything.
All right. Shout out to all 300.
I got nothing going on.
Shout out to all 303 of our patrons. Shout out to these patrons in particular who pledged $10 or more. Nick DeStefani. Oh, by the way, Nick, I know you may have been waiting for an answer to your question on this podcast, but just in case you were wondering, Sam and I answered your question on the midweek Castilla podcast. So shout out to Nick DeStefani. Shout out to Frederick Sundros, Leon Stavronakis, Bjorn Salvador, John Fernandez, Said Mahad, Sergio Monleon, Red Bat, Anthony Vasquez, Yahya Ibrahim, Nick Ribeiro, Eric Rogers, Sheikh Atiri, Ian Marley, Dan Bertha, new patron, Dan, welcome, Andrew Gomez, Anton Hackberg, Jimmy Obeid, Daniel Smith, Solomon Ortiz, and Jeanette.
Woo! You guys all rule. Thank you. And tell your friends. And if you have questions, especially if you're a certain... person who has like 10 Facebook accounts, you know, you could get us to answer your question by donating $5 a month. We'll answer your questions. That's not a joke. Like we have agreed to do that. So if you're listening to this show and you want us to answer $5 a month, we will answer that question every single time.
Yes, we will.
It's true. It's not wrong. And if you give us even more, like Ian will write an entire article.
Oh, fuck, Kian, you got yourself into that one there.
If there is a hell, it's writing a weekly article about why Kovacic needs more minutes. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's great talking to you guys, and we'll talk soon. All right, until then, a la Madrid.
A la Madrid.